Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of October 16th, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. My name is Neil Janssen.
And I'm Mayan Kreisman. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on the air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have our weekly news roundup. No panelists today, it's just our lovely selves. Then we have an interview with Mark McLean, the president of the UBC Faculty Association, to talk about his role in the Gupta affair and the findings from a recently released fact-finding report. May the exegesis begin.
All right, let's talk about news briefs. We're going to run through these quickly because we have a feature interview with Mark McLean that we want to give time to. This is a trifecta of shit that's kind of gone down at UBC this week. First of all, there is no venue, apparently, for the block party. The UBC has effectively put the kibosh on the year-end event because they do not want to give the AMS a license to have the event at Thunderbird Stadium, and the alternative that they're proposing is really small.
What's not clear to me about this is what permit exactly UBC has denied them. I don't think it's the liquor license, and the UBC's reporting did not make clear what permit UBC must issue that they're unwilling to issue.
The AMS president, Aaron Bailey, is incensed, and he's kind of gone to bat in the media over that. So we'll see if he manages to advocate against that decision and reinstate the block party.
And I don't know why it has to be on Thunderbird Field exactly. My alternate location for block party that I suggested when it had to be moved is the rugby fields. It's a huge grassy area right across from the frats. Seems like you could hold a pretty sweet party there and not bother too many people.
Yeah, and then the other one was right out front of the new nest, which of course is not grassy, so people can't really set up their blankets, but it's a big open plaza.
The strangest aspect of the story was the report that UBC Properties Trust was behind this decision, saying that if the concert is there, their condos will be less marketable. Is that just, like, the worst of all UBC?
Yeah, I couldn't believe that they actually managed to get a statement saying that.
Well, I think it was hearsay from Aaron Bailey.
Oh, okay. Well, regardless of what it is, it's kind of what we all know to be true, but you can rarely get people to actually admit, so good job on that reporting for the UBC.
The second story today is, of course, what we'll cover later with Mark McLean, the fact-finding report by former Dean of Law and former Judge Lynn Smith was released this morning. There was a strange finding in it in that no one individually did anything wrong, but collectively the university failed to uphold Dr. Jennifer Birdall's academic freedom. How do we parse this, man?
The university is made up of people, and these people omitted to do things or actively did things that, when you collect them all together, resulted in failure to protect Jennifer Birdall's academic freedom, yet nobody is to blame, apparently. But then the third thing is that John Montalbano has stepped down, so he has taken responsibility for this, even though apparently he did nothing wrong.
Yeah, that's the only real big takeaway from this, is that Montalbano's out, both as board chair and as a governor in general. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, but we'll move on without him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good thing, both for substantive reasons and for distraction reasons. The result is probably a good thing for the university.
For the public, it's a pretty frustrating report, just because it doesn't really say anything. It presents conclusions, but it doesn't actually present you with the fact used to get to those conclusions. And so it says things like that UBC failed Dr. Birdall, but it doesn't really say what happened to cause that failure.
Right, and the explanation for that was that these details are in the full report, which is not going to be made public because of various labor relations privacy issues and because the people that were interviewed to get the facts in the fact-finding report still have to work together at UBC, and so the Faculty Association and the administration agreed in the original terms of reference that that would not be made public. And so what we have is the sort of higher level summary, which for a fact-finding report, as Neil pointed out, doesn't contain all that many facts.
John Montalbano made a phone call to Dr. Birdall, and then people in the Sauders Dean office also talked to Dr. Birdall, and ergo, academic freedom was interfered with. It doesn't really make any sense.
The third kind of piece of bad news this week is the international tuition hikes that were announced on Wednesday. This is a major hike of up to 50% over a few years. And we have published on the blog some board documents that show that this was planned from early 2014 and that by 2019, international student tuition is going to be a bigger source of revenue than domestic student tuition. Somebody that tweeted back at us after that story today asked if UBC is turning into a private institution with a public subsidy, which I thought is not a bad question to ask.
And that wasn't just someone, that was an MLA with the provincial government.
Right, with the Liberals.
Yeah, with the party that is you know, arguably responsible for cutting the funding and creating the situation in the first place.
Right. So check out the blog for some more details about the numbers on those tuition increases for international students.
Another UBC story is that journalist Mohamed Fahmy is back in Canada after being released from prison in Egypt, and he'll be joining the faculty at UBC Journalism.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say about that is I saw this cute, I think it was a tweet, where the faculty of journalism took a photo of his mailbox, which is all ready for him, and he already has something waiting for him in it.
All right. I'm sure he'll be a minor celebrity when he gets on campus, and he can do the tour of giving talks around. And you'd think what he really would want right now is probably just to settle in and get his life back to a little bit of normalcy.
Honestly, he seems like a media gadfly, so I'm sure he's lapping it up.
Okay.
That's it for News Briefs.
Want a say in the way your country is run? Then get out and vote. Are you a UBC student? Do you live on campus? Then your AMS is a great and easy way for you to do that. Both advanced voting on October 9th to 12th and general election day voting on the 19th will be taking place right here on campus. It's fast and easy. No need to pre-register. Just show up with your ID and proof of residence. Visit www.championthevote.ca for all the details.
You are listening to UBC Insiders On Air. Our guest today is Mark McLean. His day job is as a professor of teaching in mathematics, but the side gig that's been keeping him fairly busy lately is as president of the UBC Faculty Association, a position he's held since 2014.
Of all the representing bodies on campus, the Faculty Association has been by far the most active and critical of the university's handling of the Arvind Gupta resignation. So let's dive in. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So just so we're on the same page, the Faculty Association is basically the professors' union at UBC, and they manage the collective agreement between UBC and its faculty.
So let's go back to the beginning, and why don't you tell us when and how you first learned of Arvind Gupta's resignation?
So on Friday, August 7th, I got a phone call from Lisa Castle, who's the Vice President of Human Resources. It was around noon, and Lisa told me that Arvind would be resigning at about 1 o'clock that day. It was kind of a shocking call to get, and it was a sort of an hour before the university was going to announce that. And, you know, I had sort of no real indications before that. In hindsight, I sort of looked back earlier in the week with a conversation I had with another faculty member who had some connection to the president's office, who sort of ended up in tears, I'll say. So it was, I never understood why until after that conversation, but it was you know, certainly shocking for me to hear about the resignation.
Now, it's been reported, but never officially confirmed by the university, that the resignation actually occurred on July 31st, and the news didn't come out until a week later. Do you know whether that's correct? And if so, why they waited a week to announce it, and what happened during that week?
I have certainly heard that as well. I'm not sure that I've heard it from so many places, I don't know that I have an authoritative source for it. I guess I believe it. You know, there had to be some setup between a declaration of resignation and, for example, getting Martha Piper to agree to return to the university, for sort of lining up the announcement, for engaging a public relations firm as they did, and so forth.
So what do you know about the provincial government's involvement, if any?
On the day I had heard the president had resigned, I sent an email that's now public to the Minister of Advanced Education, Andrew Wilkinson, just to ask for a conversation. In other words, this is a major event for the university. It's coming without any real explanation. Immediately, nobody believed the stated reason of, you know, returning to be a computer science professor. And so I simply asked for a conversation, and I heard nothing from the minister's office until about 11 or 12 days later. But in my own conversations with Mr. Montalbano and Mr. Lindsay Gordon, who's the chancellor, about the resignation, they both mentioned that they had they knew that I had written to the minister, for example, and I had not announced that publicly. So certainly there were conversations going on between board members and the minister. But beyond that, I know nothing.
Yeah, it's why can't they at least talk to you about it?
Yes.
Even if it's just to regurgitate their prepared line.
No, that's right. And so, you know, I think there was, had various conversations in which, with Mr. Montalbano, for example, where I expressed sort of my concern that the minister had put out a press release that basically called this a personnel matter. The president of the university isn't just another employee. It's a major leader. Typically, we have such a person for, 8 or 9, 10 years, and they're expected to have an enormous impact on the university and hence on the province. So, just a personnel matter is sort of insulting, frankly, to all of us.
I'll just interject and articulate that this was a freedom of information request to the provincial government to provide any and all communication around the resignation of President Gupta. And the only communication that was provided was one between you, Mark McLean, and the ministry. So that's not a whole lot of communication that was provided.
Yes, no. And the ministry never received formal notification that Gupta was no longer the president of UBC.
No, that's right. I mean, there are pieces here. I don't think you have the resignation of the president of the university happen without conversations with the ministry, at least to inform them, let alone to discuss the fallout and so forth. It's also curious for me. I actually sent a second email following up on my first one, sort of asking why I hadn't gotten a response yet, and if you're not going to respond to me, at least tell me you're not going to respond to me. And it was even days after that I eventually received the, please go away letter.
Do you think we're ever actually going to find out in a substantial way what really happened? Or even just, substantially more than we know now, if not even the full story?
There's far more to it than simply the president decides to go back to his department or decides that he's not doing a good job or something. The answer to that question really is, will the Board of Governors and Arvind Gupta ever get together to discuss whether or not they can both speak more to the resignation? Because of the confidentiality that's around this, which is not driven by his exit, but in fact by his contract, and then there's this non-disparagement clause that's in the exit agreement. So people sort of dance around not saying anything. Some of this is certainly generated by, I'll say, breaking that non-disparagement clause. There are individuals who know more from being on the board or so forth who've made private comments, maybe a little too open.
But it does sound like you have some inside knowledge of the exit agreement, which is not public as far as I know.
No, I think that piece I certainly asked about. I mean, I asked some technical questions.
Well, I think what I was trying to get at is, it sounds like you know more than you've let on publicly, and I know Mayan has a lot to say about that.
You're sort of the master of the cryptic tweet or cryptic Facebook post. Yeah, so I went through Mark's social media and collected some choice examples.
Am I in trouble?
I am gobsmacked.
Quote, first law of holes. When you are in a hole, stop digging. This always seems so obvious to me, but apparently not to others.
Quote, anyone looking to hire a used and slightly bruised mathematician?
Yeah.
So, Mark, you put these things out there, and then all your concerned friends sort of pile on and ask you what's going on and what's wrong, and then you're stonily silent. And I have to tell you, Mark, because we're on friendly terms,
yes.
And I feel like I can. This is a social media faux pas. It's a big no-no.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an attention-grabbing no-no to do this.
Okay. So my apologies for that, Mayan. And when you're in an organization that has, I have an executive, but it's effectively me supported by this executive. I'm in every conversation, right? And the university has often hundreds of people who work on things and then get back to me and so forth, that it's sort of a stress piece, right? Do I know more than I speak? In the sense that I've had more conversations with people I trust their information, if you will, than probably most people. It's not my information in the first place. And secondly, you know, I have some documents and not others. I'm not the person to blow the whistle.
In theory, how do you think the board model that UBC has is supposed to work with regard to interacting with faculty and staff and students and the stakeholders at the university?
So certainly there are people elected to the board who are there to bring those perspectives. They're explicitly excluded from being viewed as democratic representatives of those sort of constituencies. That's part of the code of conduct of the board. The meetings are very scripted, where you don't see a lot of debate and interaction, for example. There's certainly limited general space for concerned members of the university community to make presentations to the board. It's not a trivial thing to make a presentation to the board.
They don't usually take delegations or presentations.
That's right.
They only have their staff or administration.
That's right. And it's also very closed, right? I mean, the fact that we have this policy 93, which is about closed board meetings, and you realize that almost everything the board does is closed.
Yeah, secrecy is a big issue. I asked at today's press conference about the fact finder report, which we'll get to next. Mm-hmm. I asked Doug Mitchell, who's the chair of the board's governance committee, if there were any governance changes to the board as a result of everything that had happened. And I specifically asked, you know, are you going to be having more open meetings? And his answer was essentially, we're thinking about it. The governance committee recently met, but it was in camera.
You know, it's sort of, you speak into it, it's like speaking into a box, and your voice doesn't even echo. It kind of gets locked up in there, and you don't even know, you know, if they're going to respond to you. There's no obligation to respond to you. There's no obligation to actually consider concerns that you bring. And, you know, we're bringing concerns that are broad concerns of the faculty, you know, and it's if you're not listening to the faculty of the university in any way, then that's a serious state of affairs for the institution.
Do you have a brief outline of what you'd do to fix the board if you had your druthers?
Oh, well, I think some of it is certainly opening up the board more. Basically, the board structures in this province are such that they're left to their own device to make up the rules under which they operate. And these rules, you know, at the moment have no teeth, and they have no effective, you know, public accountability, let alone accountability within the institution.
So let's move on to the fact-finding report around the Birdall affair, as mm-hmm. we like to call it. That report came out this morning at a sort of big to-do at the Chan Center, where the media was invited, and there was a whole panel of university brass up there to essentially deliver John Montalbano's resignation. It's a rather confusing report. Basically, it says that nobody did anything wrong individually, but collectively, UBC failed. What's your interpretation of that?
Oh, I've been thinking about that for the past week. We, of course, received the full report last Wednesday. So there are a couple of things. The university did not actually present an important finding this morning. So there were sort of two pieces to this. They presented the Smith Report finding, that is, that the university failed in its positive obligation to protect and support academic freedom. But the second piece is that Professor Smith found that in fact, that the university had interfered with Professor Birdall's academic freedom. That was not clear in the university's press conference this morning.
Well, that's right, because actually there's sort of some wiggle room, and I've seen headlines describing it quite differently, because some of them will focus on the idea that nobody was found culpable, and other ones will focus on the fact that sort of everyone was found culpable, or UBC was found culpable.
The terms of reference say, you know, was there interference with Dr. Birdall's academic freedom? And, you know, she very explicitly said, yes, there was interference with Dr. Birdall's academic freedom. So, you know, from that perspective, what she also said in her report is that no individual's actions on their own were the cause of the interference in the academic freedom, right? In other words, there was no infringement due to just simply the fact that Mr. Montalbano made a phone call, or simply the fact that a particular person spoke to Dr. Birdall and so forth, that it was the accumulation of acts and omissions throughout a particular time period that collectively together, that set of acts and omissions generated the interference with academic freedom.
When I was going through it, I found it very curious that there was a distinct lack of facts presented in the fact-finding report, and I guess the basic journalism question of who did what when was never really answered. It was talked about in very vague terms. Can you elaborate on what exactly went on there?
Part of the not well-reported publicly piece of this is a piece of a labor relations process. This was a process in which we jointly decided to engage fact-finders.
Well, okay, let's just cut to the chase here. The fact-finding report acknowledges that Montalbano made the call to Bernal, and that is something that everyone agrees on.
Yes.
But it doesn't really say anything about the content of that call other than that there was a call.
No,
and that's not very helpful interpreting what possibly could have gone on.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. You know, I think that Professor Smith struggled writing that report, frankly. I suspect usually you write an executive summary and it's a report that, you know, people can go then to the full document and look at. That was never going to be the case here. There's the confidentiality around all labor relations processes. You know, I think it's frustrating for the public and you know, can I tell you more? The answer is no. I have to say no.
So the thing that was announced today was that John Montalbano was resigning. And I read the Faculty Association statement, which was also released today, and I was a little surprised by it. It did not have a conciliatory tone. I was wondering if you knew that John Montalbano would be resigning today, or if you learned that at the same time as the rest of us.
I learned that only just before the press conference, so I was given a pre-conference look at the university's press releases and a statement from the president, but only just before. We had written this over the last couple of days, certainly chose not to pull it. Everything in it we still wanted to say. You know, he I think, put his reasoning around it being a distraction for him to be there for the university. You know, I think that would probably be true.
And the people involved, it does get a little bit strange because Martha Piper is the one issuing the apology to Dr. Bernal, even though she, in theory, was not involved at the time. She had been announced as interim president, but not to take office until September 1st. And the person who was in the hot seat then is Angie Reedish, who was acting president during that time. And so it seems like Angie Reedish is arguably the one who failed Dr. Bernal in terms of not taking a forceful stand on behalf of the university in defending her academic freedom.
There's another finding in this report, which is that, of course, in the early parts of the university's response to the kind of media that was coming around Dr. Bernal's blog, you know, the board chair and the chancellor were speaking with basically staff members who manage public affairs for the university, and not speaking with the academic leadership, including not bringing in Dr. Reddish to that conversation. So, you know, I have a hard time blaming Dr. Reddish for not being part of a conversation which she wasn't brought into and didn't know was going on at the time.
Well, I'm thinking of specifically on August 17th, when that infamous secret board meeting happened. At the end of that, they trotted out Dr. Reddish to read a statement about how much UBC loves academic freedom. And while there, she read that statement and professed that the board had full confidence in John Montalbano instead of, you know, the path not taken, of course, now is that she could have and probably should have been instead taking a stance that Dr. Bernal was completely entitled to be publishing what she had published.
Yeah, and I think that particular moment, and I've sort of identified that in my own thinking around this, isn't just Dr. Reedish's responsibility. That's an entire board, which includes some other faculty members, by the way, who you know, at the end of the day, chose to ignore the academic freedom question. You know, Martha Piper was out today, of course, as the chief spokesperson for UBC. You know, if you're going to declare that the institution has failed, of course, the chief spokesperson has to take that responsibility. I would say that I didn't hear what she said today as an apology. And I, you know, I don't think that Dr. Bernal heard what the president said today as an apology. The "I regret" kind of language is not... Dr. Bernal has been, you know, harmed here, right? There's damage to her reputation, for example. You know, she was felt reprimanded. She was felt silenced, you know, and I think felt ostracized from the institution that should be at very least saying, you know, you have the right to say this.
I'll read a short passage from the summary report, which is a little bit silly. So Lynn Smith writes, "The key points at which I found failures were... In the short period just after the resignation of President Gupta, Mr. Montalbano and Chancellor Lindsay Gordon worked with UBC staff on the communication of responses to the flood of inquiries and commentary from the university community and the media without bringing in the academic leadership of the university. Partly as a result of the absence of UBC academic leaders from that conversation, no one thought to advise Mr. Montalbano against telephoning Dr. Birdall when he said that he intended to do so. And so that's painting it as, well, no one stopped this man from doing what he was doing and doesn't take credit for the fact that he proactively decided that he was going to call her. The failure is supposedly that no one stopped him, not that he was deciding to make the phone call in the first place. As if Montalbano didn't have a choice in the matter.
That's how Professor Smith interpreted what she was presented. You know, are there individual things in the full report that probably each side would address and quibble over, if you will, or think were not correct conclusions? I'm sure we could. It's a very long document.
But are you pretty much happy with the report and the summary and the process?
I think I'm happy that Professor Smith carried out the process that she had, you know, in a very fair and impartial way. This report's purpose now, for us at least, is to guide how we will have the conversation around remedy. You know, for us, in order for this to be the right instrument, it has to accomplish the right remedies.
From my reading of the various statements you've put out, the tone has been pretty aggressive, and even in this conversation, you'll be very clear and say things like, I am dissatisfied with XYZ. And it seems very distinct from the way that our student representatives see fit to do advocacy, at least right now.
I'm not sure I would have thought of it all as aggressive, but I'm not the only one interpreting what we say. Certainly faculty speak very directly, right? So every communication we've had, for example, has effectively been written by 15 faculty members, goes through quite a writing process. You know, we also speak from a place of certainty about our role in the university. We're, you know, long-term members here. We, you know, most of us individually see probably 4 or 5 presidents through our careers. So that's a space that students, for example, don't so easily have. They're a much shorter-term members of the community. I think around some issues, we have access to more information. Much harder for, I think, student organizations to get access to that. We've almost never filed a Freedom of Information request as the Faculty Association. I may be the first president to do so, as I have recently. Typically because the university will simply hand us information that we ask for in these processes.
Well, so I think we'll wrap it up because we've kept Mark for quite a while and he's going hoarse. So we want to thank Mark McLean, who's joined us in the studio, the president of the UBC Faculty Association, for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and you know, I hope I was able to provide some insight. You know, I've admired this podcast since you've started it, simply because I think it kind of puts issues out there, and you know, it's an opportunity to try to get us all to unedit what we say.
Well, thank you very much. Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver, podcasted. Oh God, we still don't know where we're podcasting. Just go to the blog and follow the links. You can follow us on Twitter as well, at UBC Insiders. Check out the blog, ubcinsiders.ca, or email us. We're easy to find on Google. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, Mayan. And we'll talk to you next week. Our interview guest then will be John Robinson, who recently left UBC to join U of T, but he was most recently UBC's Provost of Sustainability, so he'll give us his thoughts on that.
Can't wait. Insiders out.